Good morning. Welcome to this episode of the Ad Drop Podcast. This is one of my favorite podcasts. We have The Brain Trust, Craig McMichael and Tony Siracusa from Last Word on College Sports, SRA, Sports Radio America's, my guy Memphis Spence, and Sons of UCF, Andrew Glukov. Fellas, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey,
Good
morning,
morning.
Chris.
How's
Good
it going,
morning.
guys?
Here's a thing I wanted to bring up. A little bit of a side story. When I cover Division II and III sports, there's been kind of a clash between conferences and some of their fans because a lot of conferences, or not a lot, but some of them have started to seek out streaming deals with low sports or various other carriers because they're trying to out offset the high price of collegiate athletics. Now, the people who are upset at this, they claim that some of the fans, the conferences are alienating fans, but the conferences are saying there are schools closing, which I can name about five at the top of my head in the last year or two, and there will probably be five more before the end of next year. I'm gonna start with you, Craig. What do you think of smaller conferences enabling or having their games streamed or televised on a streaming site for pay?
I think it makes a lot of sense. So I'm also big into the lacrosse community, and that is the way which you can view most of these. And you see it where a lot of conferences will have an ESPN Plus affiliation, but you also have Flow Sports. You have the University of Denver that has their own like streaming package. Some of these places have it where it's monetized, where you have to pay for it. And as a fan, you have to make that determination: is it worthwhile enough for me to watch this sport? Watch this conference by paying for it. But I mean, it's reality. And the problem is, as many fans are used to, hey, we just want something for free. I don't know how many of you guys get yelled at if you're some if something you write is behind a paywall, you get yelled at because, oh my gosh, we have to pay for it. Well, listen, these conferences, the media companies, they have to keep their doors open. So I think they have to do what they've got to do. But if you're going to be paying for it, that stream better be solid, it better not lag, and it better not go down, because I think that's when you're going to open up a lot of issues and problems.
What's your take on this?
Well, this we forget college sports is a business, and schools and their athletic departments have tried to create arm length deals. As a support arm organization, you see it in Florida a lot. It's grown because of the legal protections that come with it. Athletic associations are not technically a direct part of the university, but they're a support, so they have a degree of separation. They have to balance their own budget, manage their own facilities, and do what they can do to keep the lights on. Well, smaller schools don't have the support of the large Division I conferences, so they got to scrape however they can get by. And you mentioned it, schools are shutting down, especially smaller schools. Division two and three schools. And that's because stuff such as declining enrollment, tuition that's just growing too much, and the cost of maintaining the athletics program are all bleeding together, because at the end of the day, someone has to pay the bill. And if you can't, you shut down. So they're looking for ways just to keep things going. And here's the truth: if you're a fan of a school, what's $10 a month? $15 a month, you can budget that. That's less than two value meals at McDonald's. You get a quarter pounder with cheese meal, that's going to run you basically $10. So you budget for it. I think people are looking at it conceptually and getting kind of almost like faux rage at the idea that I have to pay to watch this instead of seeing it for free. But the reality is, it's not all that price cumbersome. They just don't like the idea of doing it. But that's the way the world works. Even the people who post, articles and stuff for free, they still have to pay for their website, hosting and all that stuff. It's not free. They're just choosing to pay for it and not passing the cost on to you. So I it's strictly business.
Spence, what's your take?
I agree with these two gentlemen, and I'll raise them, not only sports, any media. I'll just be blunt. from my standpoint, any media that you're not paying for now will probably be out of business in 5 to 10 years. The cost, even though the servers or whatnot are the cost of those are going down. Advertising is not a viable means to supplement. It can be a supplement, but it can't be the main means of smaller organizations and companies to really base their content off of now. A subscription, even if it's just $5, $10 or whatnot, that goes a long way than Google AdSense money in paying bills around there. And I can tell you, for the smaller conferences and for smaller schools, they're going to have to set up, and maybe it's a joint revenue share subscription site or whatnot, but they're going to have to figure out another way to monetize the content. Because if you're not hitting on some of these broadcasts, the cost of actually producing the broadcast, even at a small level, is $300 to $500, and your ad revenue is not getting there unless you have at least 5,000, 10,000 people watching for a good amount of time to run enough ads to hit that. And that's just covering costs. That's not making profit of anything. So paying a little bit, if you have games that may be of value to somebody but may not be value to the masses, then charging for those games makes a lot of sense. And the people who want to see those games should take pride in supporting their school, supporting journalism, supporting whatever it is that they're actually watching. I think that we have gotten spoiled over the past few years, especially with a lot of free content. And we know that, or we should know now, that all the free content isn't necessarily good. And I'll definitely tap Tony Siracusa on the shoulder for that, because there's a lot of free content out there that's false. There's a lot of free content out there that hasn't been edited. There's a lot of free content out there that people haven't even taken the time to call an actual source to verify it. And if you really want journalism, if we're people that really want to invest into truth, then think about paying, making sure that the people that are actually out there responsible for getting it, think about putting some money in their pocket so they can at least buy some coffee. And I'll stop on that.
Tone, the same question to you. When you look at the landscape and you see the outrage, it's usually from just either fans or even some media are a little bit testy that they have to fork out money to watch a Division III school play another Division III school within that conference.
Yeah, look, I agree with everything that's been said, but I want to veer my answer a little bit. I think part of it is the smaller schools, the Division II and the Division III, looking down the future and seeing this as a way to protect themselves financially, because as much as we, the global sports fans, want to hate the NCAA, the NCAA helps finance Division II and Division III athletics. They're now looking at this as the NCAA taking a financial beating, whether it's in court, whether it's legal fees, whether it's from the conferences, whether the NCAA is even going to exist as an oversight organization in 2 to 3 years. And the schools are looking at it as, in a proactive sense, we can't rely on all of our money coming from the NCAA anymore. We have to look at other options and other avenues. I do understand a small portion of fan discontentment about it, not really targeted at, Denver University or, whatever D2 or D3 school charging for this. I think the discontentment comes from a pile-on factor, whereas you used to just subscribe, you get what you get. So much of what we watch now has become a la carte pricing for streaming. And so all of a sudden, yeah, sure, it's only $10 a month. And so you sign up for it. And then when you're looking at your credit card bill or your bank account or whatever, and realize you have eight different streaming fees coming at you every month. You're like, holy crud, man, here's another one, you know? And it, because it's the way we watch sports now is, you know, an excessive amount of, you got to go here for these sports, here for those teams, here for these games. And it does start to add up if you aren't really checking what you're watching, what you're subscribing to. So I think really there is a little bit less of the, hey, we used to get it for free and now I got to pay $10 a month. Yeah, the $10 a month is nothing until you add it into all the other streaming fees you're already paying. And then if you got kids, you're also paying for Disney Plus and you're, you know, paying for Hulu so everyone can watch their movies. And, you know, all of a sudden you're paying, you know, $150 a month in streaming fees.
Kind of like a cable bill.
Exactly.
Yeah, it sounds like cable.
announcement with ESPN and Fox and all the Warner Brothers, and they looked like, we're going to bundle our sports products. And my response was, wow, imagine that, an outlet where you have a bundle of different sports entities showing games. It seems like there's a name for that. Oh wait, it's called cable.
Nope. It's like
you
that scene in
Reinvent the Wheel.
Exactly. It's like that scene in Goodfellas where they burn down the guy's place and he has to sign over the insurance. He's just like, that's right. Us when we have to sign over the streaming. And I talked to a D3 commissioner this week and they said how they're in scramble mode. Like the next 5 years looks a lot like the last two, where not only are they losing schools to closing, they're losing active schools to other conferences. There was one D3 school that dropped down to NAIA because NAIA, you can offer scholarships.
Yep.
And that future is bleak. And for me, I get the fan spot, but to Spencer's point, Spencer hit the nail on the head. It's a symptom of being spoiled. Like, sports are expensive. Like, everyone here has played them. They're expensive. Like gear, time, whatever, it's expensive. And is you have to invest in it. Now, Spence also brought up a point. I want my next topic. This week, we had a parent of a college athlete contradict and actually call out a news outlet and about his thoughts and his quotes. Tony, the first question is to you. What do you, when you look at everyone calling themselves journalists or news outlets, in your mind, what makes a credible outlet?
Wow. All right. Well, let's take the next hour because I can tell my colleagues on this show are all having a good laugh that you picked me first because, gosh, it's not like I have any thoughts on this topic. Look, the digital media site that published that Alabama was tampering with the quarterback from Arizona, and they ran it with no verification, no backing it up, no proof. They ran it attributing it to other sources, other people, other sites, with no legwork of their own. This is offensive to me. It should be offensive to anyone who cares about real journalism, real media coverage. It's offensive. But I also understand that's the way the digital media world works. And it's unfortunate. Now, I don't want to be the old guy standing on his lawn yelling at the kids to, you know, get off his lawn. I get it.
I'll do that.
My challenge, frankly, is in equal parts with the site, but with the consumers of media who have become so incredibly lazy that they look at that headline and it's inherently true. Did you read the article? Did you say, wait a second, where did they get this from? Hey, wait, I'm seeing that the quarterback's father came on and completely refuted it, debunked all of it. And that site who ran that came back at me for some of my criticisms. And I'm not about to back down. You know, you have to be able to back it up. Because now what happens is this thing, this story has a life of its own now, because it's now on all the Facebook fan pages and it's on everything else. And hey, is this true? No, it was debunked 5 days ago, but everyone still is living off that headline. It's like when, you know, Marvin Harrison was going to get the $25 million NIL deal. The story was complete garbage, but it ran for 2 weeks. And so it's horrible, but you have to have an audience. You have to have consumers who will check the story, read it, ask questions. Where did you get this information from? Look, do they actually source it? Even if it's anonymous sources, that's fine. As a reporter, we've all used anonymous sources before. That's fine. As long as you can back it up. These guys weren't able to back it up at all. When they were arguing with me, it was a lot of, yeah, but this, yeah, but it was a lot of whataboutism. But that's where the digital media world is. Anybody with a site has alleged credibility. You know, if they've got 10,000 followers on X or whatever the case may be, it's unfortunate. It makes it hard for those of us who do real media work to combat that. We may not have the page views that some of these guys do, but I'll take our work over theirs any day of the week.
Vince, same question to you. You, as someone who has had a long, successful career in media and journalism, when you see something like Tony had mentioned, and when you see news in quotes being just thrown out there without any sort of sourcing, any sort of credibility, what makes an outlet credible to you?
Well, Tony said he's not going to be the old guy standing on the lawn hollering, and I will be. I'll gladly take that from him and do just that, because when I was growing up and when I was in school, it was called yellow journalism. I don't know if that term still exists out there, but it's basically journalism with no credibility. It's tabloid journalism, and that was what you stay away from, because if you got to that point in your career, you might as well, you know, you could be mowing lawns. Yet, it seems as if the public has taken to this type of tabloid or yellow journalism in sports and really across the board more often than not recently. And that's why I'm a cynic on this. If that's what they want, then give them bad journalism. But I don't, if there are still people out there that want truth, that really do want sourced content, that really do want objective information, then you're going to need to pay for your journalism, because those are usually the sources that can afford that. A lot of people aren't doing the they don't have the time to do the research or the calling. But if you're going to call yourself an actual journalist, and you know it's not a level of money that you have, it's a process. You have to go through the process. You have to be able to source at least two, is it in school? There's at least two sources to tell you, you know, that this is true, and they need to be firsthand sources, or you need more than two. It's a process that you have to go through to call yourself a journalist and actually source real content from real sources and real people. If you want to protect your sources, there are ways, and there are certain criteria that we look at and on whether or not we're going to do that or whether or not we should do that to protect a source. Sometimes, you know, it's in the best interest of everybody involved to do that. Sometimes you just need to name your source. It just depends on what the situation is. But if you're going to call yourself a journalist, and I want to see better journalism out there. I've made a career on trying to show guys the right way, show gals the right way, show people the right way to do it from school on. You know, that's what Sports Radio America is about, is doing this the right way, going through the process, understanding why you need an editor, understanding the levels of detail that you need to put into your work, and still trying to figure out how to make it entertaining, how to connect with your audience, you know, everything involved in journalism today. But it's a process. It's not a name, because as we've seen, with recently, most recently, I'll call them out, SI. You know, they weren't going through the process in their journalism. I know that's not the parent necessarily, but the company that they hired to actually run the rest of the sites, they weren't going through the process. Some of them didn't have editors. Some of them even had AI writing the stories unverified. So there's a process that you have to do as a journalist, and that's how you become a journalist, and that's what real journalism is, as opposed to yellow journalism and tabloid. Now, like I said, people want that. Give them what they want. If people want to eat garbage and junk food, give them what they want. But if people want meat and potatoes and real stuff, then they should expect to pay for it at some level and be proud that they are and have a relationship with those journalists, because those are the guys that are going to, and those are the guys that are going to take the time to research, to make the calls, to source the content so that you know that you're getting good verified information.
Drew, when you look at it and when you see an alleged rumor or news that will just emanate out of thin air or someone's rear end, when you look at it, how do you analyze and kind of judge a credible outlet?
Well, as we've seen, even credible outlets get it wrong. You know, there are times where they get caught up in the rumor, and they run with it, and they realize, oh no, we screwed up. Here's soon a credible outlet and clickbait. The credible outlet will backtrack, say, hey, we got it wrong. We messed up. We're sorry. Because they have to restore the faith. The clickbait, like this story that we're talking about, they doubled down. I saw the comments that Tony was receiving. They were doubling down, as opposed to, you know what? Maybe you're right, or yeah, we got it wrong or something. No, they doubled down on the fake, basically the fake news. Because obviously, you know, the parent comes out and says this didn't happen. You know, I'm going to take the parent's word for it, not some publication that I already know was suspect to begin with. You know, I'm not going to mention the site by name because I don't want to give them any credence for clicks. But I've read stuff on this on that site before, and there wasn't credibility to begin with. So when I first saw it, I took it with a massive grain of salt. But this generation, you know, old, young, basically we're, you know, the social media internet generation, we're looking for instant gratification. So basically anything that gets brought to us that's posted, we take it face value, which is not good. Not good at all. So, you know, anyone, even legit organizations like ESPN can push a narrative really easy and make you believe whatever they can convince you the sky is green, you know, and run with it and make you believe it. You know, look at how people have bought into the college football playoff without forgetting the fact that the foundation underneath it has not changed with the Associated Press and the FWAA awards and the coaches and the fact like, hey guys, those are still there. They're still doing the same thing they've been doing from time immemorial. The CAP is just something built on top of that. Still a foundation underneath. But because ESPN told them that stuff doesn't really exist anymore, to them, it doesn't really exist anymore. We're very impressionable. We're very easily manipulated because the media has learned how to manipulate people. And, you know, it's all psychology. And you're going to find people who actually care about digging into it. Like one of the websites I use, I use Google News just to kind of see different stories going on. But if there's a story that interests me, I'll look up and see what else is said about before I really believe it fully at its word. You know, just insert topic here. Oh, that's an interesting topic. I'm going to start looking up that topic elsewhere, see if I can find corroboration. But most people they don't want to waste their time like that. Like, oh, I got 5 minutes. I'm going to read this article. Boom, done. Move on. It's just, we've gotten so fast as a society. We don't stop to smell the roses. We don't stop to verify the truth. And as a result, we are easily manipulated into believing stories that are made up just for clicks.
Greg, same question to you. When you look at the landscape of what is and what is not considered a credible news outlet, what are your criteria?
Well, I feel like I'm going to go back being little Craig who's 10 years old, going grocery shopping with his mom and seeing the story about Bat Boy, right? We looked at it. We knew that was goofy, right? But I'll come back to the word of, like, process, narrative. You know, am I sharing it with a group I'm in on Twitter, a DM group or Facebook group? I'm quicker to share that. I've been guilty of sharing it. I've shared stuff that's wrong. Hand in the air. I've shared stuff that's wrong. You know, I've been out there. But if I'm doing it and I'm writing a story and I know my editor's going to be looking at it, I'm going through process. And that's what Matt talked about. You know, what's your process? I'm not just going to take what one site says, but I'm going to follow that trail, trying to follow the NIL trail of, like, did Carson Beck really get a Lamborghini this week? Or was he, you know, was it a photo op or anything like that? It's figuring about what is that process. And it makes it hard for when you're actually going to write a story, because you know, you're going to put the time in, you're going to put the process in, trying to connect dots, trying to talk to sources, trying to find out who else is saying some of these different ideas. But you also know that when you go to market your piece, you've got to have something. You've got to have some sort of hook there that's going to make someone going to look at it, because they're going to want to click on that first, because the reason that site's going to work is they're all about clicks. They don't really care about the story. There doesn't need to be a story. There just needs to be a catchy headline that looks good on either Twitter or looks good on Instagram, looks good on TikTok. But it makes it hard, and it's trying to figure out what is the process, what is that end result. I know at last word when I'm writing that I've got an editor who's going to be looking at it, is going to push back if I say something maybe a little here and there. So I'm going to have to make sure I've got my ducks in a row to make sure that that's going to make sense. But if I'm just sending something in a group message, whether it's on Twitter or whether it's on Facebook, I may say something without necessarily looking at it all the way, just to kind of spark that conversation. And that's that process that we go through, you know, as, you know, journalists and as what we're looking at it. But as consumers, there's going to be folks that they just want to read about Bat Boy. But some of us want to figure out, is there something more than that?
I want to add something onto that real quick.
Before we jump off this onto another topic, I want to address something Andrew said, which is something that is important to me, and that is the willingness to go out front and say when you are wrong. That's what gives you the credibility. To put something out on our last word Twitter feed, and I have done it before. When we put something out there on Twitter, and a couple hours later we discovered we were wrong, and I literally put it out there that said, and we didn't try and hide it. We didn't say, oh, but this, but that, like Andrew was talking about with this story this last week and the site that did that. We said our sources were not good enough. We did not do enough of our homework. We got it wrong. We apologize. Here is the reality of what happened. And we were wrong. If you're not a site that's willing to admit when you're wrong, you're not a real site. You know, the sourcing on stuff, look, I posted stuff. It wasn't even for an article. It was stuff to engage folks on a certain West Coast university's college football program in the past week about their head coach, you know, looking all over the country for other jobs, both in the NFL and in college. And people are like, oh, it's just rumors. It's just, look, I was sitting there at a concert in Charlotte Friday night, texting back and forth with two members of this coach's current staff. It was not just rumors. Was I going to name who it was? Of course not. They saw the job with that university. So of course they're going to be unnamed sources, and they will remain unnamed sources. And that's how they come to me, you know, because they know that I'm not going to out them. I have other sources who will tell me, hey, if you want to use my name on this one, it's fine. Go ahead. Not a big deal. And then other ones will say, I need you to keep this out of my living room this time. And I take those things seriously. You know, back in another lifetime, when I was a news reporter in Fresno, I went to jail on contempt of court charges for protecting a source. We were doing an investigative piece on the local police department and entrapment news, and we were working with the Fresno Bee and the radio station I was at, and the judge ordered us to turn over our sources on how we were getting the intel on the police department, and I refused. And literally right there in the courtroom, he said, bailiff, do your job. and I was in handcuffs and went to jail for contempt of court. I will stand on that. I mean, look, it was Tulare County Jail. I was in there with some guys who were, you know, convicted of driving their John Deere tractor while intoxicated, you know, folks like that. But I will stand on that. Absolutely. And a million times in any time. So it's okay to have unnamed sources, but it's also even better if you can name them from time to time so that the readers see, hey, this is a guy who's got some sources. He knows what he's talking about. But the biggest thing that I wanted to emphasize before we wrap this up is what Andrew said, being willing to admit when you're wrong, own it, put it out there publicly.
Yeah, real quick before I just want to throw in one more thing is, and this is more indicative of our time, is the chase to be first. Mm-hmm. And yep. As a result, there is a growing chance of getting something wrong because they aren't doing their due diligence. They aren't doing their proper editing. A lot of these sites don't have editors at all, yet alone ones who actually give 2 cents about the quality of work. It's the chase to be first, to have the breaking story so that other publications like SI, ESPN, CBS have to say, oh, this is attributed to this guy, broke the story. So a lot of times it's about the chase to be first, which means you have to cut corners in the integrity of the work, as opposed to, you know what, like my last website, I used to work with SB Nation and Black and Gold Banneret for UCF. Our editor, his comment was, I'd rather be right than first. Let's take our time. And you know what? We weren't big on breaking stories. We'll let the Orlando Sentinel and the beat writer there take care of that. Just because they had more resources to put into it. Okay, we're cool with that. But we'll analyze it and we'll dig into it after the fact. But it's a lot of these guys care so much about being first to get the clicks that they don't care about the quality or the accuracy. It's just about, you know, again, it's about, you know, clickbait.
And to co-sign on Andrew, first of all, Tony's absolutely right. Part of your process should always be printing a retraction when you're wrong. I even do that on the radio. If I'm wrong, I'll come on and say, no, I was wrong about this. And you need to know this. But definitely in print. And the reason why people are rushing to be first these days and they don't care whether or not they're wrong is because it doesn't cost them anything. Back in the day when we were at newspapers, if you printed something wrong, it cost you something to print that retraction. In social media, you just throw that out there these days. And on digital, you know, you just throw it out there and it doesn't cost you that much more to print it or retract it or anything like that. But now that everybody's rushing to be first, if people could just take the time, and, you know, I say this to all journalists, take the time to do it right the first time. Just listen to what your grandma used to say, do it right the first time, son. And, you know, if you take the time to go through the process, and that process involves, if you get it wrong the first time, print the retraction, state the retraction, make sure there is a retraction, because if there's not, then you're not doing the process correctly. But that should always be part of the process.
For me, I kind of look at all your points. I kind of think to myself, I am 10 years old. It's 1984. I'm writing a book report on, I have no idea what, it's been so long, but I'm at my grandmother's house and she looks at me and she looks down and she points to my last name, which is also hers. This, anything you put your name on, make sure you do your best to get it right, no matter what it is. And you have to make sure if you write it, you have to make sure it's right. But to that point, to all your point, also got to, if you're wrong, got to apologize to it. I'm not just going to just throw out any kind of randomness. I've been writing about the NFL about a decade now, about 1,600 articles in. I've broken one story. Brandon Bolden signs with the Las Vegas Raiders. That is it. I've heard other things. I never ran with them because I wasn't sure. This one, I actually had to hear from a family member. And to me, it is making sure that you do your best to get it right. When I see a lot of these sites will just speculate or just throw on, you know, rumor this. I can't traffic in rumors because I still remember being 10 years old. I still remember that the fact that I have two little kids, and long when I'm just a picture on the wall, my words will still exist. And I don't want anybody saying, well, your great grandfather was this. He didn't do. No, it's this. It may be antiquated and out of date by the time they read it, but it will still be the best of my ability. When we come back from break, we got to talk about politics and NIL, which is always fun, but it is what we need to do. You are listening to the ADRA podcast on the FPC Radio Network. Welcome back to ADRA podcast. Terrence Biggs, Craig McMichael, and Tony Siracusa of Last Word on College Sports. Andrew Glukoff from Sons of UCF. Memphis Spence from Sports Radio America, College Credit Hour, everywhere. We have an issue, fellas. I want to start with Craig first. Craig, we have politicians in NIL. You have politicians from various states grandstanding. You have attorneys general from different states grandstanding. What's your take on it? How would you f immediately fix that?
My take is maybe they should stick to politics instead of stick, and let some other folks stick to sports. It's a lot of grandstanding. It's a lot of hot air. It's a lot of noise. They're yelling about guardrails, but like I'm not sure what to do with the NIL space. It is messy. I don't think the NCAA does. I don't think the conferences do. I wish I had a clearer answer. But to be quite honest, they should stick to politics, and it's out of their zone. They should stick out of it. I don't know how many hearings I have to hear about Ross Dellinger going to sit in Capitol Hill to hear about the NIL, and they're going to talk about this, and they're going to talk about that, and you hear things, and you're like, if your college football coach heard you, like in the state of Georgia, talking about, we should limit NIL, we should do that. I think Kirby Smart's going to approve of that. Do you think Brent Key's going to approve of that? So, to be honest, I wish they would stay out of it. There needs to be some sort of solution. I'm not sure what that is going to be, but I know it's not what the politicians either at the national level or at the state level.
To you, when you see various politicians who like to throw their hat into the unfortunate kind of melding between collegiate athletics and politics, what comes to mind, and is there anything that could be fixed to stop this nonsense?
Boy, I don't. There isn't an obvious and quick answer to any of this. We didn't get here quickly, and we're not going to get out of it quickly. We didn't get into it smoothly and cleanly, and we're not going to get out of it smoothly and cleanly. It's going to be bumpy. It's going to be ugly. There is a need for changes in the portal, in the NIL. Clear, the NCAA cannot do it. Every time they try to do something, it takes about 72 hours before someone's filing a lawsuit because the NCAA does not have antitrust exemptions and protections. But Craig brings up a good point that Congress is going to sit there and look at different bills, and the Marsha Blackburn, Cory Booker legislation seems to always get the most traction. Because it does grant the NCAA some protection by creating a national landscape that is legislative. But here's what ultimately happens. It's going to cross someone's desk, and I'm not even naming names. We'll just say, Senator Joe Smith from the great state of Texas doesn't like the way this is going to impact his Longhorns, and he's an alum of the University of Texas. Well, so it doesn't, I don't like the way this impacts the Longhorns, so I'm a no. Not, it has nothing to do with whether it's a good idea, whether it's needed, whether the process works. I'm a law school graduate of the University of Oklahoma. And as the senator from the great state of Oklahoma, I'm killing this thing. There's a reason why to this little agreement, this between the Big Ten and the SEC. One, because as Memphis Spence has been saying for, oh, I don't know, 3, 4 years, college sports really is a power two, not a power four or power five. It's a power two. Those are the power two. But what it does right now is it limits the voices. We have too many voices on this coming from all sorts of places. This limits the voices. And for Greg Sankey to say one of our first topics to discuss is the need for NIL guardrails, and for the acknowledgement that Greg Sankey, as the commissioner of the SEC, is the most powerful person in college sports right now, and for him to say this is topic number one, or at least at the top of the list, carries some traction. It's an advisory committee. They don't have the ability to create new rules. They don't have the votes of everybody across the country behind them, but they do have the ability to come up with some thinking, with some plans to make some changes. Again, it's not going to be quick. If you're looking at, we're going to fix the NIL by the end of the year, you're chasing unicorns. If you think you're going to change the portal by the end of the year, again, even if Congress were able to give the NCAA some backbone, this is the United States Congress. Nothing happens quickly. It'll be a year or more before you even get there. So it's going to be a bumpy ride. It can get there. But taking the politics out of it is going to be near impossible. When you look at the amount of United States senators or ranking members of committees in the House who are graduates of schools of the Power Four conferences, they have their own personal interest involved. And as long as you have that, it's not going to be easy.
And what's your take, Spence?
NIL is much like a lot of other things in business, finance. It's a new market. And markets take time to kind of figure out exactly what needs to be regulated. However, I still think that there could have been more done on the front end to at least set up an advisory board. The NCAA probably should have set up an advisory board to actually monitor what's going on with NIL and then listen to, have somebody that these commissioners and these coaches can call about NIL issues, because for as far as I know right now, that's not available. They just are hollering at the wind or voicing stuff at pressers in hopes that somebody hears them, up top. But it's going to take time to suss out, just like any market. And NIL is a fairly new one, which we don't really have. Even the people that study this stuff like I do, I still don't have a great grasp on what needs to be regulated and what can be regulated, because there's a lot of things that people want regulated that aren't, you can't, if you regulate that, then, I mean, the free market's going to go directly against you and you've created another problem. So, but I think that there are people that should actually be watching this, figuring out what the guardrails should be, and putting things into place that they can actually enforce. The problem that we've gotten into lately with a lot of this stuff that the NCAA has done is they have rules in place that either they're not enforcing or nobody can enforce, and that's why they get broken so often, which just leads to taking down banners and pretending games didn't get played after the fact rather than true enforcement up front to make sure that there's an equal playing field from the beginning. In terms of the politics, politicians need to understand their place. They need to listen to their constituents. I'm not going to say that they shouldn't be involved, but they need to be getting real information from the powers that be inside. And I guess vice versa. I don't want to step into their realm. They shouldn't step into mine, but we should be able to work together at some point because we're all here for a specific reason. Them being able to take calls. Now, I heard a lot of them say, hey, I took this call from ex commissioner or this athletic director, and we agree that blah, 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 blah. That sounds more credible than I'm from the, I graduated from this college and I need votes and I'm going to say this because I know it's going to make people feel good. That's not going to get anywhere, and that's grandstanding. If they're about actually making true inroads and doing something, I mean, you could do like Charlie Baker and sign up to be the commissioner for the NCAA if you want. Now that's a job I don't know if anybody wants, but you know, if you really want to make inroads and stuff, get jump head first into it and actually get in some real conversations, because we're dealing with something that is going to actually take, in my opinion, not only the commissioners themselves, but maybe some lawmakers involved, at least at a national level. On a local level, probably not, but on a national level, to actually set up guardrails that actually can be achieved. Because as far as the states are going, states are making rules right now. Tennessee has different rules than Missouri, who has different rules than Florida. And if the jurisdiction of this already looks federal to begin with. But I think that if there's a lot of people that at least are talking to each other, maybe there can be some sort of people can get on the same page and come up with some true guidelines and something that all of the universities are going to be able to not only police, but follow. And it's advantageous for everybody to do so. That's my take on it.
Drew, on a minute left, last word to you. What do you think is the why we have this combination between politics and NIL?
Well, remember, the politicians are elected officials. They need votes. And one of the best ways to appeal is to do something for your biggest schools, a Georgia, a Florida State, you know, where we know where the attorney general in Florida filed against the CFP for stuff. But, you know, Memphis Spence mentioned Missouri, and I think this is a great case study on how the system is so broken. Missouri last year passed a law where NIL was allowed to be given to high schoolers before they make the college, as long as they sign with a public university in Missouri as a way of keeping players in state. That's almost a cheat to win kind of thing, because you're breaking the norm, giving those schools an advantage. So all these states are kind of playing out for themselves. So there's going to have to be something above, you know, maybe not so much as a bill built in for NIL, but the NCAA needs the ability given to them to go after this, to level the playing field. Cause right now it's the Wild West. Pretty much anyone can do anything at this point, you know, short of coaches, you know, driving kids to go pick up some food. It's just a broken system.
Exactly. It is definitely a well needed conversation. I want to thank Craig McMichael and Tony Saracusa from Last Word on College Football, Memphis Spence from Sports Radio America, and the College Credit Hour, Andrew Glukoff from Sons of UCF. Fellas, thank you so much again. This has been an informative Mensa meeting and one of the best episodes of the Last Word on College Sports. That's Tony. Last on the Ad Drop podcast. Thank you so much.